I sometimes say to my students at Trinity Seminary in Columbus that the gospel is a summons to live creatively and courageously in an inescapably ambiguous world. I mean, that's that. Everyone knows that as the Luckian formulation. You know, I mean, it's just part and parcel. I'm always saying that. The gospel is a summons to live creatively and courageously in an inescapably ambiguous world. And that is really much of what I want to articulate today, extending some of the thoughts that I was sharing with you yesterday. It comes in a willingness to give up control. And in this, the gospel of Jesus Christ and its impact upon the human heart and upon human community and human interaction, human life, the impact that we know as life in the Spirit, provides, it seems to me, a framework for balanced living amidst all of the relativity, the pluralism, the change, the insecurity, and all the responses to that that are part and parcel of the world at any time, but that take a particular shape and have a particular forcefulness in the United States in our own time, in our sense of an America come unglued, as I have been calling it. It seems to me that the gospel encourages us to live with a sense of certainty at the center of our lives, a kind of gyroscopic center. But rather than being the certainty or the security of a wall that's around us, a wall where we know we have everything under control, we have everything all figured out, we have all the answers, we live within the airtight, unquestionable system and all the rest of it, there is instead a kind of gyroscopic center that leaves the perimeter of our life open in all directions. On the contrary, on the other side, the certainty or the sense of security that's provided by authoritarian systems, and particularly authoritarian religious systems, it really is that of a fence or a wall. It's a protective device that establishes a very sharp line between us and them, and sets down very clearly what is to be just assumed and that is unquestionable. It tends to tighten up life and close it off, and the result is that we have isolated groups outshouting one another. As I mentioned yesterday, I think some of the crusading zeal that we find among authoritarian religious types is not so much because they really have found such a powerful healing influence in their lives that they gladly and joyfully share it with other people. A lot of that energy really is spent in trying to convince other people to buy into the system, because that way, the more you can convince other people to buy into your system, the more you have a sense that your own doubts don't have to be taken seriously. The doubts and the questions that you keep suppressing is taken care of if you can stick with your own kind and encourage others to believe just the same as you do. The sad result of that is not only rigid personalities, but also what some people are calling bumper sticker warfare in the United States. You know the bumper stickers. They're all over the place. Reducing life and significant issues to simple slogans that you can reduce to something so brief you can stick it on your back bumper, and that's your response to the rest of the world. It's captured in the spirit of one bumper sticker that I've seen that simply says, "God said it, I believe it, that settles it." You know, and end of discussion, end of inquiry. And it seems evident that God said it. And of course, I don't question that, and that takes care of that. Well, it's that kind of mentality, regardless of the position that's being held or the community that is being affirmed. But convinced openness, it seems to me, has a very different spirit. It is a spirit that lives out of something larger than itself. It is not just a shallow relativism either. Relativism says, well, you know, everybody's entitled to their own opinion, and every opinion, each opinion is good as anybody else's, and or else, well, we all really ultimately believe the same thing, and which just is not true. That is all patently untrue. Not every opinion is equally valuable. And we don't all necessarily believe the same thing or hope for the same things or have the same outlook on life. But from the standpoint of the Christian gospel, Christians dare to believe that there is a grace and a power and a promise that is greater than every one of us, that is actively at work in our midst, that gathers us all up, and that promises to bring our lives and the lives of all people into a fulfillment that they themselves cannot establish. It seems to me the reason why Christians can be expressive of convinced openness is because they do live out of a reality larger than themselves, larger than what they have experienced, larger than even they understand. Jesus is for us the affirmation that God is amazingly and unexpectedly gracious and creative, and that this is his world, and that he is at work within it. That doesn't mean we have all the bits and pieces figured out. It doesn't mean that we have a handle on God or that we understand God fully. Even somebody like St. Paul could say, we know in part and we prophesy in part. I wish all Christians could reaffirm that and enter into that spirit deeply. It's like that old-time religion, it was good for Paul and Silas. Well, there's part of what was good for Paul and probably Silas too, that we know in part and we prophesy in part. We don't see it all. We don't have it all figured out. We don't see the reality of the fullness of the reign of God. We have glimpses, we have the foretaste of the Spirit, but we don't see how everything all turns out. That doesn't mean, though, that we're just wandering around the map aimlessly without any clues and without any affirmations and without any vision and without any convictions. But it does mean that we affirm what we do believe and what we do see and what we do sense in a spirit of openness, recognizing that there's more to God and the meaning and purpose and fullness of God's will and wisdom than you and I have figured out on our own or even pooling our joint resources. This means openness to people outside of the church, openness to people who are even are critical of us, because it is an expression of what it means to live under the claims of a truth and a goodness that is greater than all of us. So that is a more qualified way of seeing things than either absolutists or authoritarians on the one hand and the privatists or relativists on the other hand. It is saying we are not left aimless, we are not left without guidance, without insight. It is not as if we have no sense of the claim of God and the meaning of God for our lives, but it does mean we don't have it all figured out. And that's why we need one another, and that's why we also need people even outside of the church, because sometimes that's how God rebukes the church. A good example of this is precisely what the Christians in China are saying. What is amazing, absolutely amazing, is that China was the focus of the greatest single missionary outreach of the Christian church that one can even think of in modern times. More energy, more personnel, more money, more time was spent on China than any other country. 1947-49 came, the missionaries began leaving, and finally all were left by 1950. The Chinese Christians were left alone. Along came 1966, 67, the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. Every church in China was shut down. Every Bible that could be found was burned. Every hymnal that could be found was burned. Christians were persecuted. The leadership was scattered. The seminaries were closed. Christianity, for all purposes, was annihilated. And at that point, there were something less than a million Protestant Christians in China. The Cultural Revolution lasted for 10 years. Bit by bit now, the churches began to open. Now they're discovering, conservative estimate, there are 4 million Protestant Christians in China. The church quadrupled under the most adverse of conditions. There is something going on in the world. There is something there that lays claim to the church. But in the process, the renewed Christian church in China is saying, we accept the impact of the Marxist revolution as God's way of criticizing the failure of the church to be a prophetic witness to the needs and claims of justice and the needs of the poor. And so, interestingly enough, the Christians in China, rather than seeing even the pain that they suffered under the Marxists, they still say this can be indeed God's instrumentality, the same way that the Jews could see a pagan like Cyrus as the Messiah. You know, that's right there in 2 Isaiah. First mention of the Messiah is of Cyrus, the Persian, a pagan, who is seen as God's instrument, because God is at work in the whole world, even beyond the confines of our community. So it's that kind of affirmation coupled with openness. Now, in this regard, there's a wonderful story in the Old Testament that I think captures what this is about. And it's the story of Abraham pitching his tent by the oak grove at Mamre. And while he's there, three strangers show up. And something about the character of that story I think is very, very intriguing and very instructive. It says in the story, these three strangers show up. And Abraham goes out of his tent and extends himself to them in more than one way. He not only literally extends himself going outside of the tent, but he also extends himself by way of hospitality. He invites these three strangers into his tent, and he entertains them. And while they are there visiting with Abraham, these three strangers say that his wife, Sarah, is going to conceive and bear a child. And of course, Abraham is very old, and Sarah is very old, at well past childbearing years. You know, Sarah laughs from behind the tent flap. That's why the son that finally is born is called Laughter, or Isaac in Hebrew. But it's God's joke. It's God's little joke. And it actually happens through these people. Now, in the Hebrew mind, things don't happen unless something is said. The way things occur in the world, the way significant events occur, is when a word is spoken. That even carries over the New Testament. Mary conceives Jesus by the word of the angel Gabriel. So Sarah conceives Isaac through the word of these three strangers. If these three strangers had not spoken the word, Sarah would not have conceived. And these three strangers would not have spoken the word if Abraham had not invited them to his tent. And so by Abraham's reaching out and extending himself, he suddenly discovers there is blessing that is shown to him and through him, because now through Isaac is established the whole lineage of Israel, and Israel becomes a source of blessing to all the nations of the world. That is the promise. Now, I think that is really a wonderful story. Abraham is not boxed in. Abraham doesn't shield himself from these strangers. Abraham encounters people who are alien to him, but he offers them hospitality. And this is true. This is true for the whole of Abraham's life. It's very paradigmatic of Abraham. We first meet Abraham when he's Abram, and he's in a settled city. He has a settled existence. He lives within a wall. He lives within the wall of the city. And this God comes to him, this strange God, the voice of this unknown God saying, leave everything behind and risk yourself and just take a flyer, you know, take a chance on me working with you, and we're gonna leave this place and leave your whole security system behind, all your subtle life, all your financial security, all your family connections, and follow me out into the wilderness, and I'm going to lead you to a land of promise. And then the question is whether, you know, is Abram going to do this or not? And he does. And later on, St. Paul looks back at that and says, in this way, Abraham demonstrates that he is the ancestor of the entire community of faith, because his whole life now is grounded in this risk and trust. So so it's very characteristic that Abraham, as he finally is renamed, who is this person of risk and venture, and who is wandering around the world living in a tent, not a tightly walled security system, is resilient enough and courageous and trusting enough and open enough to invite strangers in to his, the circle of his life, and in so doing is blessed. So the author of Hebrews, in the 13th chapter, the second verse, remembering this story, says to the early Christian community, "Do not forget to entertain strangers, for by so doing, some people have entertained angels without knowing it." And what are angels? They are the messengers of God. So what is your spirit and outlook when you encounter someone who is a stranger or an alien, whose point of view and whose outlook is different from your own? Do you pull back within the safe, secure, stout walls of an unquestionable belief system? Or are you willing to live in a tent-like faith that is willing to risk even encounter with strangers? And it may very well be that in entertaining strangers, you entertain the messengers of God without realizing it. All too often, as a 19th century English theologian by the name of Maurice, F.D. Maurice, once said, we are more right in what we affirm and less right in what we deny. See, that's so often the way it is. And we are only cutting ourselves off from a richness larger than ourselves when we live on the basis not just of our affirmations, but we also have within the our way of thinking and our way of looking at people and other systems of this whole business of a denying. We don't want to have anything to do with them because we feel safe with what we know. And what we don't know makes us a little nervous and sometimes makes us angry. I mean, isn't it interesting how we react sometimes to modern art? I mean, perfectly sane, rational people get all upset about modern art. Oh, this is nonsense. Oh, my grandchild could do the same thing in his bare feet. You know? Well, there have been attempts to try and do that. There once was an experiment that was done. Some people had chimpanzees just splash paint on a canvas and then showed it along with a few other things to a panel of judges. And they looked at the stuff by the chimpanzee and said, this is terrible. This is awful. So there's something going on there that you and I don't necessarily see. But people who are in that area and who are sort of tuned in can sense. The reason why we don't like it is it's obviously more than you and I understand. And we don't like it. We don't like to live with anything or be confronted with anything that we can't figure out. We don't like a world that's bigger than we are. But Abraham somehow was able to live in one. And that indeed is the style of life of all the children of faith, all of the descendants, the spiritual descendants of Abraham. They are willing to trust in a God larger than themselves and therefore express a certain flexibility and mobility in life. Our faith in God is a call to openness and risk. It is not a weapon to use against the stranger, the alien, the person who is different. So therefore, as I mentioned last night, and I'll just mention this briefly tonight, life in Christ really is living on the road. It's not living in a box. It's living in risk and openness and growth. And it means, therefore, embracing anxiety. We've talked a bit about that, the nature of anxiety. It means living with anxiety and embracing anxiety, not trying to shield ourselves from it. Living with our limits and our freedom. Because we live within our limits and with our freedom, with God, with something greater than ourselves, in which we trust. So, embracing anxiety is not such a weird idea. Jesus himself enjoins us to do that. He says, enter by the narrow gate. And the word anxiety comes from the Latin word meaning narrow. Enter by the anxious gate. Enter by the narrow gate. Enter by the gate where things you don't have the control. Are you willing to do it? Are you willing to risk? And in so doing, Jesus does not threaten us, and Jesus does not cajole us, and Jesus does not patronize us either. In this wonderful passage in John, Jesus says to his disciples in the last evening there together, henceforth I no longer call you my servants, but I call you my friends. Jesus summons us to be his friends. He summons us to be, as it were, partners and equals in a way. Not to be underlings. And therefore, our call is a call to a life of maturity in which we're able to take risks and live with insecurities and uncertainties. But I discussed a lot more yesterday, but I just wanted to call our attention to it. And it's also the case that in following Jesus, Jesus doesn't simply say it's going to be all peaches and cream. There are going to be really tough times. There again, there's this wonderful phrase, again from the fourth gospel, about I am the vine and you are the branches. And every branch that does not bear fruit is cut off, right? And thrown into the fire. But then what does Jesus say about the branches that do bear fruit? That is, if you're a faithful disciple of mine, what happens? Can anyone remember the passage? Yeah, you get pruned. Who wants to get pruned? No, stop beating on me, Lord. Stop snipping at me. Stop giving me all this difficulty and the struggle and the questions and the uncertainty and the pain. Now, Jesus says that's the way it works in a vineyard. You're the productive vine, or the branch on the vine. You get pruned. Why? In order that you bear even more. That what's going on in your life, the humanness of your life, is enriched that much the more. And what you offer to God by way of your life is even richer. So that, I think, is the model that the gospel is pointing us toward, is this convinced openness. There is a gyroscopic center to our life. We hold on to words that are spoken to us that have power and meaning, and give us a sense of stability, and give us enough to go by. They don't give us all the answers, but they give us a sense of a core to life that enables us to then move out in all sorts of directions and not just wander all over the landscape. And part and parcel of this is that we stand within a community and a heritage and a tradition. As someone once pointed out, we don't grasp the universe barehanded. Remember, a while back, we looked at how we're social beings and how much we have a world, not just an environment. And that world is something that we just don't invent. It is something that comes to us through the shaping influence of our culture and our tradition and communities. So there are communities and heritages that are ours, and we're just dumb if we ignore them. People have to sort of make up the meaning of their lives out of thin air, or think, you know, like they somehow just go into themselves and they discover all wisdom, you know. I'm just encountering some of the New Age philosophy out here. I'm hearing something about it. I'm not encountering it. I'm just hearing about it. You know, you channeling and all that sort of business. I mean, come on. That's going to be the source for wisdom. And you have the rich heritage of so much around that has stood the test of time. And you're not going to learn from that. You're going to somehow dredge it up out of your spiritual toenails. Well, you know, if that's the way you want to go, live with your superficiality and call it wisdom. But look at the rich wisdom that is there in the past and the heritage that is ours. Paul Tillich said that in the depth of every living tradition that has stood the test of time and that has touched the lives of countless numbers of people, and especially a tradition that's been able to interact with differing cultures and differing historical periods, there is something of eternal significance that is to be known there. The problem with relativists, privatists, is that they have no stable center. They have no gyroscopic center. They have no tradition. They have no community. They're just wandering over the landscape according to the latest whim that comes along and carries them away. Within the church, we have a community of insight and wisdom and mutual support. And we're just foolish if we ignore that. We're only depriving ourselves. And that becomes the gyroscope. And to affirm that tradition by entering into it more deeply. There's more to Christianity than you can even imagine. Why don't you give it a real chance? Why don't you really dig? We have the heritage of the saints and the great teachers of the church and people whose lives resonate with power and meaning. Hang around them. Learn something from them. There's something going on there that is so deep and rich, your whole life you'll never be able to capture it all. To ignore that is just foolish. And to think that somehow you're going to get caught up by this whim or that or make it up as you go along, you're only cheating yourself. And you're only cheating the communal character of human life, and especially the character of our corporate life together in this nation, retreating into separate, isolated lives. So to affirm a tradition, though, doesn't necessarily mean to be closed off. If at the same time you have that gyroscopic center, you're also open, creatively open. And this leads to the public arena and what Jesuit John Courtney Murray used to call argument. That's how you deal with differences. You don't ignore them. You don't wall yourself off from them. You build a community of creative interaction, of honest interaction. And it doesn't mean you always agree, but you agree to disagree and to take the other person seriously, recognizing that all of life is process, and part of the process of life is placing oneself under the truth and under the deeper claims of justice that are always more than what you and I have already experienced or known. Now, this is not simple, shallow relativism, but it's what Gabriel Marcel calls counter-intolerance. Counter-intolerance. It means you take your own convictions seriously enough that gives you a kind of empathetic clue about taking seriously the convictions of other people or recognizing how they're taking their convictions seriously. And the result is creative engagement, public encounter, public discussion, public debate. That's what we need, not bumper sticker warfare, not right to life, right to choice, and that sort of thing. We need creative interaction with counter-intolerance built into those who are sharing and witnessing. That's what's needed in the experience of Rainbow on the Mountain. It's not just a matter of blaming or castigating. It's a matter of creative dialogue, creative interaction. Now, as I said, I think that the gospel is God's call to us to live creatively and courageously in an inescapably ambiguous world. And that means an inescapably unstable and uncertain world. And to do so, therefore, without surrendering to authoritarianism on the one hand or relativism on the other hand. And I think that this is needed far more than ever in the United States and in the life of American culture. because the present state of American life is such that Martin Marty describes it as, quote, half the population seems to have given up on pluralism and the other half on faith. Okay? Half of us seem to have given up on openness and the other half have seemed to have given up on conviction. And what's needed is convinced openness. That's what our nation and our culture needs. The gospel of Jesus Christ promises that our life has ultimate meaning and value far beyond what we can even know, certainly beyond what we can achieve. And this life of ours has meaning and value even if it cannot be reduced to simple formulas. This is God's world, and God is trustworthy, and that should encourage us to accept the limits that we find in life at the same time that it encourages us to accept our creative freedom. It seems to me that the very heart of all of this is expressed in the essential core of life in Christ that St. Paul outlines in 1 Corinthians 13. Now, Paul, by circumstances, is pushed to the point of having to finally define what for him is the very core of life in Christ. What does it consist of? And then he begins in the 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians to elaborate that and talks about the primacy of love. And then in the last verse, verse 13 of chapter 13, he finally says, faith, hope, love abide, these three, but the greatest of these is love. Now, just think about this posture of life, because that's really what it is, a kind of outlook toward life and a way of dealing with oneself and other people and situations. The posture of faith, the posture of hope, the posture of love. What do they all have in common? Openness. They all have the characteristic of openness. To live in faith means to be open to life. Courageously open to life in spite of all of its insecurities. Faith is an openness to life that is based on trust that this indeed still is God's world and God can be trusted. That's what faith is all about, isn't it? So it's openness to life with all of its ambiguities. What is hope? Radical openness to an uncharted future. That's what hope is. Hope is the substance of things not seen. For who hopes for what he sees? Now, sometimes we use the word hope loosely. We say, I hope to go to Chelan a week from Saturday. No, you're not hoping. You're planning to go to Chelan. A lot of our hoping really is planning. Or, I bought that lottery ticket and I sure hope that I win it big. You're not hoping, you're wishing. See, a lot of our hoping really is wishing. So the thing about planning and wishing is that it really, the center of it all rests in ourselves. But hope has a center outside of us. Our hope is in God, not in ourselves. Our hope is in what God is doing and what God promises. Our hope is in the fullness of the kingdom of God. You and I are not creating the kingdom now. We taste it. We respond to it. We offer ourselves up as servants of the reign of God in the world. But the fullness of the reign of God comes in its own time and in its own way. And it's for that that we hope. And we don't even know fully what it means. Do we? So we hope for what we do not see. It's radical openness to the uncharted reaches of the future. And in a time when people are filled with despair, Christians should be full of hope because they believe in God. And what is despair? From the Latin, despero, which means to be without hope. To be in despair is to be without hope. And to be without hope is to be locked in a world that belongs just to us. As long as we live within our own world, we can fall into despair. But if, in fact, we really believe that this is God's world, and God is gracious and trustworthy, we cannot be in despair. Despair is a form of our sin. Rather, we live in hope. Even in the face of the possibilities of thermonuclear destruction. I don't remember the new inclusive language. I don't mean to belittle that. I take that very seriously. I have not yet memorized the inclusive language, but I know the older version of Luther's A Mighty Fortress, where he says, "Take they then our life, goods, home, child, or wife, they yet have nothing won, the kingdom ours remaineth." I mean, just as the world is collapsing all around us, you would think that would be the time to be in despair. Yeah, if the world just adds up to you and me, yes, we should be in despair. But if life and the world also have within them the ingredient of God and God's promises, we live in hope. Faith and hope and love. And what is love but what I've already called openness to the stranger? That's really love. Love is not sentimental sweetness. Love, in fact, can be very confronting at times. But what it has is the sense of openness to the other, even if the other is a stranger or an enemy. Love builds bridges to the other, even if the other is an enemy. Why? Because love understands that we all are united by something greater than ourselves. Isn't that what love is all about? We are bound together by something more than just us. And therefore, it is a call to openness. Openness to the other. Openness to the person who disagrees. Openness to the person who is your enemy. And that is why St. Paul can say that love is patient and kind. It is not envious or boastful. It is not rude or self-seeking. And that it can outwait and outlast everything. It never fails because it has the final word. Love is the most radical expression of openness, of convinced openness. It is nothing less than our human participation in God's own life. So the openness of faith and hope and love are a convinced openness because they are grounded in God. And as that openness works in us, we are liberated from our egos and our desire to control. We are liberated from our fear and our smallness and our own narrow vision. Let me conclude by just reading something that I've written. Authoritarians like to think they have convictions. They don't. Instead, they have security systems that try to deny anxiety. Their unwillingness to be open to others shows that they are really motivated by fear, not by conviction. The proof of this is their unwillingness to be open. Relativists like to think they're open. They aren't. They drift and surrender to uncertainty. Their inability to prevent the latest fad or enthusiasm to sweep them along, or their unrelenting cynicism about everything, show that they are really motivated by an unwillingness to risk discipleship to the truth, not by openness. The proof of this is their unwillingness to accept the burden of conviction. Our culture is experiencing a crisis of self-confidence. There are those who have lost faith and are retreating into the privacy of their own lives and the fragile tentativeness of their shifting opinions. Their underlying despair or cynicism is barely visible, but it is there. Others are manning the stout fortress walls of unquestionable authority and cocksure certainty. Their outward belligerence and intolerance mask a subterranean fear. In this setting, God whispers to the world through the gospel of Jesus Christ. His invitation is both strong and gentle. He calls us to find ourselves in him. And as we do, he gives to us deeper measures of his own spirit, creating within us richer measures of convinced openness. End of quote, end of lecture, end of series.